So, welcome to the Joint Ventures. It's our podcast exploring developments in autoimmune disease and what they mean for real clinical practice. I'm Jack Arnold, and as always, I'm joined by my co-host, Dr. Rhee Hartzibus. And this week, we're sort of having a slightly different take with EULAR 2026 just around the corner. We thought we'd do something a bit different. And rather than trying to cover the entire program, we're going to run through our own unofficial joint ventures countdown of the sessions, themes, and abstracts that we're most excited about heading into this year's meeting. And then hopefully after the meeting, we can assess how well we did and whether there were any other things that turned up that surprised us or that we're excited about. So I suppose, Riyadh, do you want to kick it off with your first pick?
So I think we have all picked four themes or sessions, what we are excited about, what I think worthwhile talking about. And my first one probably is not going to be a surprise to the audience who has been listening to our previous episodes. And you might remember that in episode two, we already talked about links between obesity and systemic autoimmune diseases. And we touched on things that's becoming more increasingly important in rheumatology, the role of weight management as part of the disease control, and particularly importance of incretin-based therapies, what are emerging in management of our field as well. So it's not really a surprise that this topic is now starting to show up more prominently in conference research as well. And the session named Basic and Clinical Abstract Session on Unconventional Targets in Psoriatic Arthritis have actually three interesting oral abstracts around this theme. And one of the key abstracts is phase three trial data of Together PSA trial, what's going to be presented by Laura Coates. And we touched upon on this study already on our episode two. And just a reminder, this study looks at combination of ixekizumab, what is IL-17 inhibitor, and tirzepatide, which is dual incretin agonist, and the combined effect in controlling active PSA. We already know from the press release that the study has met the endpoint, what was 50% improvement in PSA activity and a more than 10% weight loss in combination treatment compared to ixekizumab alone. So it'll be interesting to see more data and the details on this. And on the same theme, on the same session, there's going to be a couple of more, I think, interesting talks. One is going to present data from a DIPSA trial, what that's dietary interventions in PSA, and what is a randomized controlled trial looking in how structured dietary changes can impact disease outcomes in PSA. And then finally, there's going to be a study looking at presenting data on GLP receptor agonists more broadly and showing that treatment with these agents is associated with lower disease activity and reducing pain in PSA beyond the weight loss. So, and this result, they what is promised, they have a data which shows that this disease control and pain reduction is independent of the weight loss. And it was something that we talked about as well, that and they might have this anti-inflammatory disease modifying effect of GLP-1 agonists. What will be interesting to see. So I think definitely session to keep an eye on, and I will be definitely in audience and see what data they are presenting.
I think that's going to be a really packed session, isn't it? Because I think it's inescapable in whatever field in rheumatology you work in, you will be affected by this. It's just one of those sea changes things. And just very, very interesting seeing that data, particularly the Together trial. It's going to be a packed crowd. I think it's a busy one. So I'll go next. So another thing actually really that's going to probably apply to almost everybody working in the field. So there are a number of sessions on fatigue and quality of life, more specifically relating to CTD, but some general sessions. And one of those is on the 3rd of June at about 2:15 in the Georgian Fifth Room. Room four, and that's got a number of very interesting lectures. One looking at basically when fatigue becomes pathological, and obviously fatigue is a very common presenting complaint for patients, but unfortunately a very non-specific complaint, and sometimes something that's quite difficult to tease out. So there's good sessions in that looking at the sort of differential diagnostic approach, trying to have a structured approach to that. And then a third lecture looking at lifestyle measures and fatigue and whether that is enough. It's something that we certainly talk about probably with, 40% of our patients will talk about fatigue and will often recommend lifestyle measures. But it does remain, I mean, certainly within connective tissue disease, it remains one of the biggest unmet needs across the full, lupus, Sjögren's, the full connective tissue disease spectrum. And I think from a personal standpoint, working in that area in lupus and primary Sjögren's, we know that fatigue and these widespread pain features, they often persist despite disease activity control. And that's also challenged by the overlap with fibromyalgia-like features as well. So it is very difficult. It is inescapable in the field. And I think work in this area previously has shown that there aren't really very good there aren't good biomarkers for this for fatigue. It doesn't correlate particularly well with inflammatory markers, but it does significantly impair quality of life. And many patients will say that this is a more debilitating feature than joint pain or other symptoms. We know, but it's one that we're very, very poor at addressing. And it's just that dichotomy of the fact that we, as rheumatologists, we often spend a lot of time talking about immune cells, talking about structured disease activity scores, and we can forget that the patient experience is often dictated by things like fatigue, pain, the uncertainty, and the loss of function that people struggle with. So that's one of the ones I wanted to highlight sort of early doors, because I think everyone can take something from that session, whether you're a specialist in one area or a generalist, everyone's going to get something out of that. And I think it's going to be well worth attending.
Yeah, it's definitely. And fatigue is such a difficult symptom to manage, and it's usually most times it's multifactorial, and it's very poor to respond to any kind of interventions, and usually it's quite disabling. And on top of patients' priority list, what is troubling them most. So I think it's definitely important and good thing that you are is giving separate session on this, because it definitely needs to be talked about. And I think my next choice links with that well quite together, because I have picked a personalized and holistic medicine in rheumatology, and actually I have chosen two sessions under this theme, but what might not seem to fit together at the first glance, but I think they complement each other quite well. So the first one is named Tailored Made Treatment: The Future of Personalized and Holistic Rheumatic Disease Management. So it's going to take place on Thursday. And the second one is a basic clinical abstract session on biomarkers in rheumatic diseases, what's going to happen on Wednesday. So the first session is bringing together several talks, and all of that will center around the one key idea: personalized care. And I think the main message of this is really is important and powerful, that we're not just treating disease, we're treating people and we're treating a person. So we should always remember that. And what it means for everyday practice. It's kind of moving away from one size fits all approach. In holistic medicine, the person receiving care is at the center of everything: decision making, treatment choices, long-term management. So it's about tailoring care to the individual needs, preferences, and the circumstances. And I think in rheumatology, probably we have been quite good with that. But I think there's definitely scope to improve that, even beyond that, and get better at this. But I think what I'm particularly interested in, other layer to this as well, is personalized treatment. And it's not just being more patient-centered, it also has the potential to make therapies more effective and safer. If we could identify the right drug for the right person from the start, we can improve outcomes and reduce harm. And this is exactly where I think a lot of research at the moment is heading. There's growing efforts to identify factors, how to predict who will respond to the treatment and who will not. So I think that's how the biomarker session is linking in quite well. And there's going to be quite a few talks what's trying to identify novel biomarkers, whether either monitoring disease activity as an ANCA-associated vasculitis. There's loads of proteomic biomarkers trying to be identified in predicting flares of RA or outcomes in CTD-ILD. But I think what I'm the most excited to actually hear about is the abstract with number OP048, and it looks at ex vivo immune-derived molecular signatures on how they might predict treatment responses to JAK inhibitors and TNF inhibitors for patients with rheumatoid arthritis. So I think it's exciting because it can tackle the biggest challenge what we face in clinical practice every day, which treatment we choose and how to predict if that's going to be effective for a patient or not. And hopefully with these approaches, we will have either molecular or protein signatures what could guide us in our treatment decisions. And we will be able, with more confidence, say that this treatment is going to be the most likely what will be effective. So I think that's really the essence for me in personalized medicine, in rheumatology, in these years what are coming up.
And I agree that that abstract is interesting, isn't it? Because it anything that can help us choose the right treatment for the right person right at the start, because we all know that early induction of remission in these patients is inexorably linked to long-term outcomes. So it's not just sort of preventing people cycling through medications and different treatments. It's about trying to get on top of disease and limit damage accrual. So that's very interesting, really. And definitely something that we need more of, across the board, really. So I'll jump in now. I have talked about fatigue. I've talked about something that's general. I'm going to talk about something else that's quite general, but probably home turf for me, given the sort of work that I've done in the past, and that's the role of AI and pattern recognition in rheumatology. And there's a number of really good sessions on this. First of which actually occurring relatively early on the 3rd of June at 2:15, there's a session on clinical case solving in rheumatology, where from the details are sketchy at this stage because we haven't got the full program, but it looks like there's going to be an interactive session, both using and not using AI support, so testing people to see how they do with complex cases, which I think is really, really interesting. And then there's a number of other complementary sessions. So there's a session on big data, AI, and a lot about integrity and rheumatology publishing. Obviously, people have seen recent publications looking at the number of ghost references and AI involvement in publishing generally. So that is a huge area of interest and something, even outside of rheumatology across the academic spectrum. And then there are more specific sessions. So Geoffrey Curtis is chairing a session on artificial intelligence and research and how that can be used. And then there's a number of other, I just wanted to sort of shout out a couple of posters. Well, one poster and one oral abstract. So poster number 517, looking at artificial intelligence, looking at recognizing facial features of systemic sclerosis. And by Dr. Solomon, that looks like a really interesting poster, something that I'd be very interested in looking at because that has broad application across both resource-rich and resource-poor healthcare settings. It could be incredibly interesting and to use that and potentially transformative in some cases. And then there's another oral abstract looking at stem microscopy for ANA pattern identification with machine learning as well. And it's interesting. I think it's interesting in the context of rheumatology because rheumatology is the area, the gray area, I think, of medicine. We operate in a very gray area. We are constantly plagued by ambiguity, by difficulties of whether we attribute, attribution issues. There are overlap syndromes between multiple connective tissue diseases and other diseases. But these are all quite classic high-dimensional pattern recognition tasks. So the idea of combining CTD-related clinical features with standard of care laboratory testing with immunology. And these are where AI can in part be useful. And we've already seen that tools like CNN's convolutional neural networks have been used in ANA reading, and they show fairly good agreement with experts for pattern classification. So they can be, a tool. But in a more broad sense, there's a really interesting article, a viewpoint article by Prof. Venerito, and that was published in Lancet Rheumatology relatively recently, looking at the role of, things like agentic AI, so AI that can operate independently. And that has multiple tiers across rheumatology sort of provisions. So within that article, he discussed tiers of automation that you can use. So when these are where you have things like booking clinics or administrative tasks that don't involve any patient risk or very low patient risk, and I suppose you could argue that booking clinics in an using agentic AI is not risk-free. Could these applications operate semi-autonomously within this sphere? Would there be another sphere whereby something like letter drafting, clinic letter drafting, where we're already seeing people utilize off-the-shelf tools for that. That's where it would operate under the direct supervision of clinicians. And then there's probably, certainly currently, possibly not forever, there's an area where which the clinical risk is high enough that we wouldn't want involvement at that point. And he suggests things like medication prescribing, initial diagnosis, and those at the moment remain the purview of the assessing doctor. And I think certainly in the short to medium term, I can't see that changing just because of, the gravity of that situation. But it's very interesting, and I think it's something that we're going to see a lot of. We're a chronic disease specialty, and that makes it quite a good opportunity to sort of deploy these sorts of tools in contrast with something like acute medicine, where you've got sporadic one-off visits. There's no trend over time. We don't have multiple follow-ups. And I think we'll see these be developed more and more. And it's just very, very interesting. And something that I think generally has broad appeal across the spectrum, really.
And I think it might be different in different healthcare systems around the world, but I think in which we work here, I think there's huge potential for AI with administrative tasks. Like you mentioned, patient booking, clinic booking, patient clinic letters, and all of that. And actually, I quite welcome those changes because I think it has become so overburdened. The clinicians have become so overburdened with that any help what would be possible, everyone will be hugely welcoming that. I think I usually when I go to conferences, I like to pick up a few sessions that might not be that directly my field of interest, but kind of to broaden my horizon to my knowledge. So I think the AI one, at least, will be the one that I go on because I'm quite poor with that. So I need to get better in that. So I'll be definitely attending at least one of them. I will move on to my next choice, but I think again quite neatly links in with the theme of AI, and it's regarding spinal imaging in AxSpA. And it's going to be a clinical abstract session called Mind the Spine Imaging in Spondyloarthritis on Wednesday, 3rd of June. So there's going to be 8 oral abstracts in this session, and four, so half of those abstracts are focused on structural lesion identification in spine and sacroiliac joints, as well as how these changes progresses over the time. And I think this really highlights an important shift what is happening in AxSpA research in terms of imaging. Traditionally, we have been focusing on inflammation, how we can detect that, especially features like bone marrow edema on MRI. But now research is increasingly moving towards understanding, actually quantifying structural changes in both spine and SIA joints. And this shift reflects something we have come to recognize more clearly, is that long-term disability in OxSpah isn't driven by inflammation alone. It's driven by irreversible structural damage. What particularly is challenging is that structural progression can continue even when inflammation appears to be well controlled. And you know, it is true, and we don't fully understand the reasons and mechanisms behind that. And in clinical practice, we rely a lot on imaging, especially looking at bone marrow edema. And I think there has been a tendency that we feel reassured when we don't see it on MRI, almost assuming that disease progression has stopped, but that not always be the case. So the hope is that generating more data and recognizing patterns over time will gain a better understanding of these underlying processes. And importantly, figuring out what could we do to prevent from this structural damage progressing. For all of this, we need a long-term data, because structural changes have happened over a period of time. And two of those studies, actually, two of them abstracts was going to be presented. We'll present 10-year follow-up results, which I think is really good. Mm. One of them is going to look on impact of sex on spinal radiographic progression. And the other one is going to explore structural progression in sacroiliac joints on the MRI over the decade. So I think it's really interesting to see the data of that. There's other abstract, what will kind of tackle very practical question, which imaging and or scoring method is actually the most sensitive detecting these structural changes in OxSpah. And what I'm quite excited about is where AI comes in, is that we have always known that the CT is way better in visualizing structural changes in the bones, in the spinal and sacroiliac joints than MRI. But of course, we don't use CT that much anymore for spinal imaging, partially because of radiation exposure and because it's quite useless in terms of showing bone marrow edema. So there has been a growing interest to show how we can improve MRI techniques to better assess the structural damage. And one of the most exciting developments, I think, is something what we call MRI-based synthetic CT. So that is a technique what uses artificial intelligence, especially deep learning algorithms, to generate CT-like images from MRI data. So on this abstract 0104, we'll directly compare this technique compared to low-dose CT and how that performs in detecting new bone formation in OxSpah. So really interesting abstracts, I think. What will show and just add in more evidence, what we kind of know about and hopefully understand better what happens within the spine structurally throughout the time. And just to add on this, there is a practical skills session on imaging in OxSpah, including some new techniques that will take place on Friday. So I think it will be kind of good opportunity to practically build on these concepts and apply in practice. So if anyone is interested, I would definitely recommend to attend that.
And I think like you, that's one of those sessions that I will be booking into, because it's one of the nice things about EULAR, isn't it, that you can go to these sessions and you realize where the holes are in your knowledge and you can fill them and you sort of come out of it thinking, gosh, there was so much I didn't understand about that I now know better. Yeah. And it just that's clearly one of those very high yield sessions that's going to be massively helpful, even if it's tangential to what you might do on a day-to-day basis as well, certainly for myself. So definitely one that I'll be going to. I've gone very much into home base now with my pick number two. So not number one, but number two is the mitochondrial DNA and the interferon session. So looking at the mitochondria, the session is the mitochondria, a new culprit for autoimmune disease, It's on the 3rd of June at 2:15. Unfortunately, it clashes with the AI session, so I'm going to have to pick. The chair of the session is Professor Vital, who supervised my PhD, so that shouldn't influence my attendance too much. But they've just got some fantastic speakers, and there's Virginia Pasquale giving a talk on the origin of anti-double-stranded DNA, Eric Boyard, Rami Becerra, and Serena Calafrancesco. Just fantastic talks across the spectrum of autoimmune disease, and just really interesting. And just for anyone who's not familiar with this, I won't dwell on this too much because I'm sure we could fill 3 episodes with this. But basically, mitochondria, as we know, evolved from ancient bacteria. So the mitochondrial DNA looks relatively, inverted commas, sort of foreign to the immune system. Normally, that isn't a problem because it's sequestered safely inside the mitochondria. But under physiological stress, in the form of either cell injury, oxidative stress, netosis, apoptosis, or defective autophagy, the mitochondria can become leaky and porous. And when that happens, this mitochondrial DNA and mitochondrial RNA spill out into the cytoplasm where they shouldn't be, or the extracellular environment as well. And the immune system generally will interpret that in a similar way to a sort of viral signal. And this activates multiple innate pathways, probably the most well-known being the cGAS STING pathway, TLR9, and the inflammasome pathways, which in turn drive type 1 interferon production. And as we know and have known for a long time, type 1 interferon is arguably, one of the key axes in lupus, but multiple other autoimmune rheumatic diseases as well. And this is really interesting because this drives us away from that sort of old naive thought of patients make anti, you know, they just make autoantibodies. In lupus, we see autoantibodies, and it's unclear why. We've got a clear pathway by which that happens, and it's really interesting. It's very, very interesting because it reframes lupus from being just a primarily an adaptive immune response to something more upstream, because you have innate immune activation upstream of this. And there's a few sort of implications for that. We can see that perhaps this interferonopathy may begin before even classic autoantibodies, appear. As I mentioned earlier, the innate immune system may in fact be the initiating event, and this is all as a byproduct of sort of defective, what's often termed defective cellular housekeeping. This mitochondrial DNA has leaked out. It is where it shouldn't be, and it is precipitating this process. So a really, really interesting session. There is another excellent poster looking at mitochondrial alterations in Still's disease as well. So that's just reminding us that this is across the spectrum of disease. And very, very interesting. So this sort of shared inflammatory process. So definitely something to go to, maybe something to read a little bit about before you go. Sometimes these sessions, if you don't work in that area, they can be a little overwhelming sometimes. But I mean, some fantastic speakers in there. So if you are going to grasp it, these are the people to talk to. So I really, really think that's one to go to, just to get an idea of it.
Okay, so sounds interesting. I have to be honest, I my knowledge about mitochondria and their role in systemic autoimmune disease is quite low and very limited. So I would need to do some reading before to go there to
I think
understand what they're actually talking about there.
I will
But I think
100%
it's
be doing
interesting
that
that
myself.
it is interesting that we are expanding them, trying to expand the knowledge about the mechanisms behind the disease and about pathogenesis, and going away from kind of the classical pathways, what we think is important. Probably they are important. We're just trying thinking maybe a little bit out of the box and looking into the places where we haven't really looked into before. And obviously, I think the scope of all of this is that we identify new therapeutic targets, isn't it? Will benefit for everyone.
And it
So I
may have
think.
some relevance with something that I'll touch on later, but I'll stay quiet for
Okay,
now.
okay. So I think we are left with our last choice is probably
1H.
the cherry on top of the cake, isn't it? So my final one choice talk about, I think it's really important for the future of rheumatology research as kind of theme, and that is head-to-head trials, superiority trials. And personally, I think we need to see more of these across rheumatological conditions, and especially diseases like rheumatoid arthritis and psoriatic arthritis, where we have quite a lot of treatment options already, and that's different, and that's different from CTD when the treatment options are not that they are quite limited. And I think the reason for this is quite simple. Our treatment options have expanded hugely over the past years, and we have a choice now between different mechanisms of action, and new ones are emerging as well. So it's not longer enough just to say that this new drug or a drug works better than placebo or works better than comparing that we don't do anything. In real clinical practice, we are choosing between drug and a different drug. So when we are not choosing not treating a person and comparing that to this medication, because we're choosing between several treatments what we already know are effective. So what we really need to understand is how these new therapies compare directly with existing options in terms of both efficacy and safety-wise as well. So superiority trials are particularly valuable because they help answer those real-world kind of questions what we have. And they can also give us insight into which therapies might work better in specific patient subgroups, kind of linking me back to the personalized holistic medicine. And beyond the clinical side, they are important to inform treatment guidelines and even health economics, because they help demonstrate relative value, which matters for payers and healthcare systems. And looking at this year's program, there's only 3 oral presentations that include head-to-head trials. I haven't gone through the posters. There might be something more, but from all presentations, there's only 3. And 2 of the key ones can really stand out. So in the late-breaking abstract session on Saturday, we will see the results from BE-BOLD trial. And this study compares bimekizumab, which is a dual IL-70A and IL-70F, targets and against risankizumab, what is IL-23, for patients with active PSA. And from the press release, we already know the study has met the primary endpoint, showing that bimekizumab was superior. So it'd be interesting to see the data more about that. And the second trial was a SunStar, which is going to be presented during advanced management in RA session on Thursday. And this one compares tocilizumab versus abatacept in patients with active rheumatoid arthritis who have failed 1 or 2 targeted or biologic DMARDs. So again, very clinically relevant populations and direct comparison to what reflects kind of real world decision making. And what's particularly interesting is that it kind of shows that these trials represent a bit of the shift going into the next generation of superiority studies, because historically, up to now, most of these are the trials in PSA and RA have compared a drug against TNF inhibitor. And now these are the first trials what compare 2 different agents, and one of them is not TNF agent. So I think that's really important, because we often rely on network meta-analyses to make these comparisons indirectly, what is helpful but can't replace head-to-head randomized trials. And I think looking ahead, this kind of research is going to be becoming even more relevant, because loads of biological and targeted therapies will come off the patent. So the cost consideration will change and will have implication in decision-making and clinical pathways. And if we will have a robust data with these head-to-head studies, I think to make developing those clinical pathways and decision-making much more easier. And I think this is a very exciting area. Well, it's great to see that the field is kind of moving in the right direction. And that actually gives answers to questions what every clinician is facing every day. Someone has failed TNF, what to do next?
Right. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yes, that is very interesting, isn't it? And as I say, broadly applicable. And yeah, it's just going to become more and more relevant with each day, really, I think.
Yeah.
So I picked a probably a predictable number one for anyone who's been anywhere near a rheumatology conference in the last few years. But the last thing I wanted to talk about, and I promise I will take a slightly different spin on it to the sort of general line, is the presence of CAR T and CAR NK therapies across disease. And I think this is probably one of the first times that this has just become part of the mainstream in terms of how we're managing these patients. And there's a number of different approaches being trialed. So most of us will be familiar with CD19 CAR T and also BCMA CAR T approaches. But there's sort of growing interest and a bigger presence this year with CAR NK therapy, which has some advantages over sort of, you know, the initial CD19 positive CAR T therapies. And the reason for this, as I say, many people will know this already. We know that CD19 CAR T, that targets, you know, broadly B cells. It targets them very broadly. It is slightly different to BCMA CAR T, which targets plasma cells and plasmablast lineage cells. There is a difference between that and what we're doing with NK cells. So NK cells being part of the innate immune system. And they are different to T cells in that they are sort of rapid, what is termed rapid response sort of cytotoxic cells. So these are your shock troops straight in at the start, and they detect stress cells, infected cells, but they are rapid response as opposed to T cells, which are a much more targeted and sort of precise adaptive role. And CAR NK cell therapies are engineered cells. And they have a few advantages over CAR T cells. One, they potentially produce less sort of cytokine response syndromes with less neurotoxicity. They tend to have fewer severe inflammatory complications. And they are not autologous. So you don't have to manufacture a bespoke therapy for every single patient you see, because that is expensive, it's slow, it's labor intensive, and it does limit the uptake in some ways of CAR T cell therapies in sort of general practice. Whereas CAR NK cells can be allogeneic therapies, and they can be mass produced. So you're manufacturing a product from storage for multiple people. And I suppose that raises the question, you might ask, why wouldn't you just use CAR NK? Why ever use CAR T if you've got something that you can just manufacture, you know, much, much more easily? And it's that perhaps the CAR T cell therapy is more powerful and more persistent. So it is a much more robust therapy, and it does persist better, perhaps, than CAR NK cell therapy. But with that comes the necessity for personalized manufacturing and higher toxicity. So that's interesting. The thing that I found very, very interesting across is a perhaps quite disruptive session. There's a few good sessions. Before I get onto that, I should get onto a fantastic poster tour highlight, if only for having the best title that I've seen at this conference, which is another one, Bites the CAR T. I don't know what's in that poster. I'm very interested to go just because of that title. I think they've got me hooked. It's on the 6th of June at 10:15, so I'll be there and we'll see what's there. But there is a fantastic session looking at, you know, with the title, I Failed CAR T and What's Next. And I think that's really interesting because there is an enormous amount of hype about CAR Ts. They're undeniably very, very potent therapies. They've had some absolutely fantastic response across multiple diseases, but they have seen relapse, and they have seen people fail therapy, and that is a question that we're now probably beginning to ask more so than say last year's EULAR. And it will be interesting to see what people are doing in this situation. You know, you can, of course, redose with CAR T in some, you know, for some people. But if you fail that, where do you go? And it's a question that perhaps a lot of us didn't think we'd be asking, but we are asking it. And it's going to be something that I think, as these therapies gain more traction and are used more widely, we're going to inevitably have to deal with this question more. So for me, that is going to be the one session that I'm really interested in going. And I think if I was to pick one over the course of the entire Congress, that would be the one that I would want to see, because I'm just really interested in the debate and how people discuss that. So that's number one for me.
I find it quite interesting that we are starting to talk what to do if the CAR T fails even before it has become widely available outside research settings as a treatment option for the patient. So I think it just kind of shows that maybe realism, what has people have come into after this initial hype about the therapies that it's going to be, and then the tool, what will cure and treat the diseases, what we have not been able to control for years and years. I think people are now more re realizing that it will not be the hope what everyone was hoping, and we have to think about that there is life after CAR T cells, if they do not work.
It's undeniably just an incredibly useful and potent tool and amazing work. But it is interesting that we're having this discussion. And I wouldn't claim to be an expert in the area. And I'm going to go there with an open mind and be educated. I'm very happy to sit there and just take it all in.
So I think it wraps up our first joint ventures UR countdown episode. I find it quite interesting, and we independently chose these themes and topics, and it just kind of shows the vast variety of things what UR covers. So, and this is just a small bit what there's going to be on the offer. So there is way much more things what we have not touched upon, and I think everyone will be able to put their program and fill the days with the sessions what they are interested in. So if you're attending the meeting and you see us, please do and say come and say hello. Next month we'll be back with a full post UR breakdown of the biggest data drops, controversies maybe, moments from the Congress itself, and we'll share our insights from there. Thank you for listening to Joint Ventures, and see you next time.